like historical analog of like a Tiger tank could beat a Sherman tank, but it couldn't beat Detroit.
They have built an enormous gray zone capacity that operates in impact in the same way that like a traditional kind of blue water surface Navy would.
This is insane. And this is like a topic that comes up every so often.
Well, the topic that we were discussing before you got here, Garrett, which is the war on everything good. And this week, we may or may not have defeated Canada, the South Koreans, Iran again, NATO, but tragically, Dolly Parton. The big loss in the war on all things good was an American icon. And, you know, there's lots of clips going around of all the fun things that Dolly Parton did and said. But I think the thing that I love the most as a dyed-in-the-wool, political obsessed, like news junkie, was that she refused the Presidential Medal of Freedom three times because she had no interest in any of the politics of it, which is astounding. It's so cool. Dave is a Hill person. As a Hill person, not Capitol Hill, but Hill person as in the hills of America.
The Great Smoky Mountains.
The Great Smoky Mountains.
She's the hometown saint, the folk hero, the benevolent monarch.
I mean, we got to live through that, a modern time like folklore story. She's larger than life.
Yeah, I grew up with, Simon, I grew up with, you know, a picture of Dolly Parton and Cousin Randy on the, you know, on the mantle. They used to do duets all the time. Said she's basically the patron saint of the Smoky Mountains. I'm a religious figure locally down there, but I've been to Dolly World and seen her live more times than I can count.
That's awesome.
Reminder to the audience, our own Dave Cottle is cousins to the legendary, if Dolly is a deity or a religious figure, what does that make your cousin Randy Travis, a demigod?
He's in the pantheon, for sure.
I mean, as famous as he is, he's the sidekick. As famous as he is, he's the sidekick to an act like Dolly. But I have sung, you know, I used to sing my kids Randy Travis songs to get them to go to sleep. I have sung Do I Ever Cross Your Mind or a couple of their duets before.
So Cousin Randy, not just a fun turn of phrase, but the reality of Dave Cottle. The man, the myth, the legend in his own right.
So every month, Dolly's nonprofit distributes books. I'm forgetting what it's called. Imagination Library? Is that what it's called? So Imagination Library distributes books. And I think they're in the tens of millions, hundreds of millions of books distributed to households with kids. And like it's all about like inspiring children to read and like families to read together. And my daughter, who's 2.5, cannot wait for every Dolly drop. So we go down to the mailbox and we're like thinking every, you know, every 3 to 4 weeks we're going to get the next book. And we kind of like feel that rhythm coming. And a new one came just last week and it was like an exciting moment. I'm grateful for, you know, the joy that Dolly brought, the joy and inspiration that Dolly brought into our lives. Even at, you know, at an advanced age, she was executing. I mean, just so awesome and so much service orientation in an otherwise like prolific, you know, media entertainment career that could have been entirely selfish. Like so many people in that grouping are like very self-centered, only care about like the fame and the celebrity of it and kind of increasing their net worth and, you know, making splashy social media headlines or whatever. Dolly, in the meantime, has very quietly over many decades been teaching America's children to read. And I just think it's freaking awesome.
It's a great opportunity for me to tell you why we should eat the rich, because so few of them have that in their blood anymore. I mean, you think about like Carnegie and all like the Carnegie, there was a Carnegie Library in like every town in America because the titans of industry used to do this. And now it's the titans of entertainment that like do that kind of philanthropy, or the ex-wives of the titans of industry who are out there doing all of the major philanthropy.
Sure.
While our best guys are like, I'm going to buy a yacht. I'm sure that the billionaires of the 20s also had yachts and were horrible people, Gilded Age, yada, yada, yada. But it feels like they also built libraries. Now, we had Dolly Parton. Rip.
Well, grateful for her life and a true form of national service and patriotism. a true form of national service and patriotism. Welcome to the Goat Rodeo Podcast. I'm your host, Garrett Smith, joined by fellow co-hosts Simon Kuhn and Dave Cottle. We all work at a company called Reveal, where we are building the next generation of software-centric technologies for the warrior. And we're on the rise, we're on the run, and things are good. We talk on this podcast about geopolitics, the current events that are that underpin geopolitics and the trickle down all the way to the very tactical, and how that interacts with defense technology, venture capital ecosystem, the innovation economy, politics, and everything in between. So join us for a white knuckle ride on the Goat Rodeo on the topic of true patriotism and national service. Simon, are you aware that there is this thing being referred to as vibe patriotism? Have you heard this term?
I have not heard the term patriotism.
So I'm not going to name names. I think that gets into mudslinging and kind of slop in podcastistan. But I have recently encountered, and for many years have encountered, kind of a rising tide of sentiment coming from folks who have never actually served in uniform, have never sworn an oath, have never been to combat, have never even like exposed themselves to the potential to go to combat, claiming that engaging in venture-backed defense technology innovation and entrepreneurship is at some level co-equal to national service in uniform in terms of sacrifice and patriotic kind of, you know, fervor. I've got some interesting kind of like counterpoints here, but I would love to know how you feel, Simon. How do you feel about the notion that some like college dropout El Segundo types are claiming to be participating in national service on a par with some of the people that you and I served with?
To begin with, how dare you? And also, who do you think you are? This is insane. And this is like a topic that comes up every so often. And it also comes up in like public government service, this idea that like, oh, I serve in X or Y capacity. To be clear, participating in any form of free commerce is a privilege of the American system, underpinned by a whole bunch of really bloody wars. There is no service in it. Zero. Yeah. None. Making less money compared to a fabulous amount of money is not service. That is not a sacrifice. Right. Get over your fucking selves. This is unreal that this thing like keeps cropping up. People have it too good. Oh, we need another war, because they have no concept of what it means to suffer. Fucking none.
Yeah.
Until you've watched a 19-year-old screaming at a group of 18-year-olds to like do the single dumbest task that you've ever heard, that's the bare minimum base. That's before we even get to war. That's what they do for fun in Jacksonville. They just scream at each other and cut grass with scissors.
Or just to break in here. Or to break in here watching a 21-year-old corpsman save the life of an 18-year-old bleeding on the trail. Right? So like it is different. No, this is very different. So Justin Overbaugh, who currently serves as the Deputy Undersecretary of War for Intelligence and Security, INS, I think a retired Army officer who served throughout the Global War on Terror period and now serves as a civilian appointee in the current administration. He was writing in War on the Rocks earlier this year in a March 2026 piece called The Danger of Vibe Patriotism in Defense Tech. He wrote, "Collapsing these categories lowers the moral and social barriers to war by confusing contribution with obligation and admiration with sacrifice. A civilian defense technologist, investor, or founder can be as mission-driven and patriotic as a service member in intention. The fundamental differentiator is the decisive civilian privilege and exit option. They can quit or walk away when the risks or incentives change." And I would add on to that, and I think he goes on in his piece to say things about this, and this is really central to the commentary, is that the risk of financial downside or the risk of, opportunity cost, you know, in the defense venture world or in the venture capital ecosystem or in the kind of software-centric technology economy, like the downside financial risk and the massive upside potential are in no way correlated and in no way are reflective of the same level of patriotism that somebody who, like you and I, once upon a time stood on the yellow footprints and went off to war. And Dave, whatever the Army does, they don't have yellow footprints. They probably have something else. But
it's a different universe. It's not even like
a different universe. Totally.
There are service members who hate serving and really don't care for the policies or politics of America and are still risking their lives. So there is no amount of like good intention that moves the needle at all. It doesn't even fucking you're trying to measure light with a microphone. Shut up.
Yeah. Yeah. It does make me wonder if you could even do that. I think that the point here is that, and I loved what Justin Overbaugh said, and I'd love to tag Dave in here to maybe some commentary, having also worked on both sides of this, this kind of like vibe patriotism versus actual, you know, service in uniform in combat operations. But I love the idea that Justin makes, which is a civilian defense technologist, an investor, or whomever can be just as patriotic and mission driven, but there is a fundamental difference, right? There's just a difference. And yes, you are contributing to the national defense indirectly, and it's important. The defense industrial base is super important. But like, there is a difference between service and uniform, especially in live combat operations, and doing so from, you know, the West Coast of the United States in your 15th floor venture office, right? It's just it is exceptionally different. I mean, it is at some level capitalism, not necessarily patriotism. It is both, and it can be both, but it is capitalism, not patriotism.
Patriotism means nothing. I'm sorry to interject, but no one. There's no consistent definition of patriotism, and Americans spend half their time calling the other side of their own political process Nazis and fascists.
Yeah,
like,
that's right.
While calling themselves patriots. I have no interest in like, yeah, I do my patriotic duty. Like, what is that? Your patriotic duty is another man's fascism. Get out of here.
Sure. Well, so I think that while a mission-driven investor or defense technologist can definitely be patriotic and be a capitalist at the same time.
Sure.
Military service members are only one of those two things. And they do that at great personal sacrifice and risk to their lives and a great detriment to their families at home. It's very different. I mean, it is so different. It is a different universe, as you said.
I strongly agree with both of you. Those are completely different. It's not the same league. It's not even the same sport. To Simon's point, like, you can't measure light with a microphone. I think it was a good analogy. It is irritating sometimes when we're on a range doing a thing with the customer and something that looks like cosplaying is happening by all of these like industry capitalist folks, where they're, you know, dressed like the customer and covered in Velcro and patches, and some of the patriotism does seem at times disingenuous. However, I think there are exceptions to this, right? There are like World War II personalities that did open themselves or their industries up to great personal risk to contribute to the overall mission. I don't think that everybody qualifies for that, but like the Knudsens, the Oppenheimers, the folks that said like, I'll step aside and go to work for Uncle Sam for a dollar to solve this like great strategic industrial problem, I think register. Not in the same way, but they register.
Let's be clear. And first of all, Oppenheimer's a great example. He was relocated to a secret camp in the desert and like abandoned his life. That is sacrifice. That is not nothing. It's like, hey, you can't talk to anyone. If we catch you talking to anyone, we're going to go arrest that person until the war is over, and we're going to arrest you. And didn't force you to work. So like, these are your options. And then two, there's a huge difference between growing up in a peacetime America and developing expertise and yada, 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 and a total different one of growing up in the GWAT and being like, eh, that's not for me. Oh, I can make money. I've been a patriot. Dude, you know I'm a patriot. Like, go enlist right now. Go do it. I'm telling all of you, just go do it. I sat
not
in boot
that.
Camp next to a man that was a fourth generation of Marine officers, and the requirement was that you enlist first in his family.
Totally.
Like, you can't act like you can't make, tell you had a master's degree. Like, he had all those things. He's like, I have to enlist first. That's what this means. And there's such a huge gap in understanding what this means.
And another hobby horse topic for us on this podcast, go and enlist. Don't weasel your way into a fake commission and become an O5 off the street.
There are versions of that. Doctors, please go weasel your way into a O5. We need doctors.
Very different. Extremely different.
I won't treat you like a real guy who filled sandbags, but I do want you to be a doctor.
Totally. I mean, the medical corps is not quite the same.
I'm calling you dude to your face. It's going to be all right. But
I might or might not salute.
But please sign up.
But please go do that, yeah. Please, okay. I'm going to segue us from there into a... much more clean-cut topic, Simon. The Iran war and Operation Economic Outcast. Talk to us a bit about a bit about the last week of kind of headliner and analysis content on some major geopolitical topics. Hit it.
By my count, we're on war three in 6 months with Iran. Because there was the first war, Epic Fury, and then that stopped because we reset the clock on the congressional requirement. And then there were some more strikes. Maybe this time had more robots involved, potentially even robot boats. Big news, really exciting for our community. That doesn't seem to have produced whatever strategic effect we're looking for. If you guys know what that is, by the way, please let me know what the strategic effect is that we're looking for. I was told that destroying the Navy was going to do something good for us, but I haven't seen the Iranian Navy death throw dividends yet in my bank account. So now we're back to economic pressure. Last I checked, we were on like maximum pressure when Marco Rubio was still a senator. We have, how much more maximum can you get before, like, none, like, it's none more black, right? Like, who are we going to sanction? Who's left? Does anybody know?
I do love the idea of even more maximum pressure.
Yeah,
which is incredible. I'm struggling to find the article here.
I'll tell you who's next.
It was an Atlantic article called "Even More Maximum Pressure on Iran."
I'm accidentally agreeing with the Atlantic, but I'll take it.
The Atlantic seems like exactly your kind of publication, dude.
No, I don't. The only thing I like less than disagree with is people that I do agree with. Both bad camps.
Soft spoken, left of center, sharp elbowed, you know, coastal elite journalists. It seems
in
like
what
your
universe am I soft spoken? No one's ever accused me of that.
This was an ironic statement, Simon. Come on, dude.
So the question becomes, when are we going to grow a pair and sanction China? Because that's you want to actually, like, where does Iran get all of their money in the international stage? It's by selling oil to China. Have fun, go nuts, right? Biggest geopolitical enemy. Rip the bandaid off. How bad do you want it?
I was not wrong earlier when I referred to multiple publications, to include the New York Times, as having similar headlines. The Economist, even more maximum pressure, sanctions on Iran. And then the New York Times, I think just yesterday or 2 days ago at the time of publication of the podcast, what's more than maximum?
Yeah. I mean, we've been in like a quote-unquote maximum pressure position for 20 years. Weren't they part of the Axis of Evil? Were they in the Axis? I can't remember.
Oh, 100%. George Bush would have lumped them in right away.
Yeah. They've been top of the list since the revolution. So I'm like, how many soft levers are left to pull? You've already bombed the shit out of them. How many more levers left, period? Ground invasion. I know that one hasn't been done.
It's got to be the Iranian people, right? I mean, the economic sanctions, like, it's got to be pretty miserable to be an Iranian right now. I mean, the regime has been incredibly resilient, but they already tried uprising once. Like, at what point do the Iranian people try again?
They tried uprising many times. So here's my big question. What proof do we have that American activity makes the Iranians mad at their own government or mad at us? You can tolerate a lot of suffering if you have a shared adversary.
I have nothing really to say here except that we are now 6 months and beyond in a conflict that was billed to the American people as intended to be much, much shorter. And I actually don't know how much we can talk about it from the perspectives that we've got on the podcast, except to say that it does seem to be underscoring some of the technological gaps that our military has. Not just in technology, but magazine depth, which Dave will be talking about here in just a moment. But I do think that you mentioned in the run-up to the conversation here, Simon, this notion of robot boats. So we've seen technologies on display, everything from, you know, more air campaign orchestration and targeting and fires from the likes of the Maven Smart System, which is a combination of, you know, Palantir and AWS and a range of other capabilities that are out there, all the way down to very tactical stuff like, you know, autonomous boats rescuing down pilots in the straits, right? Like, and many, many other things in between. And then the downed F-15 pilot, I might be misremembering, 15, right? Where there was this leaked idea that there was a quantum sensor involved with detecting heartbeats within the search zone for the down pilot. And I mean, it, pretty incredible stuff.
Nowhere to
hide, potentially. And just like, maybe it's just a reminder that the defense technology innovation ecosystem is more vital than ever, despite some of our kind of vibe patriotism critiques in the previous conversation. But I think that this is a conflict where, we are again seeing the emergence of new technologies replacing technologies that are being depleted or proven ineffective in this kind of a campaign. Talk to us. Or, is there anything more to say, Simon, about Operation Economic Outcast? Go for it, Dave.
Garrett, I think that's the intent, is to replace those weapons and increase the magazine depth. But we're a long ways from there. I think the last 10 days, maybe 2 weeks of news articles has been basically building new capabilities that can be really cost effective. So run down that list. The new Joint Interagency Task Force for Counter UAS is doing a shoot off of directed energy lasers to see which lasers are ready for production, with a promise to start buying them immediately after whoever wins the shoot off, or whatever set of companies wins the shoot off. Castellon, who I think is probably on your like deal book register, just got a massive investment, and they're building low cost, rapid hypersonic weapons manufacturing. This is like ground to ground precision munition standoff, supposed to be very cheap or very cost effective to produce. The Missile Defense Agency awarded Expo a low cost interceptor contract for prototyping through production. This is about shooting down, you know, $20,000, $100,000 UAS systems with another option other than, you know, shooting $1 million THAAD at it. The Army also awarded $100 million to a South Korean mobile tactical cannon production company. This is like towed artillery replacement, you know, a howitzer on wheels, because the Ukrainians have said that it's really hard to protect your stagnant or towed artillery pieces. So like, I'm just seeing hundreds of millions of dollars, both in investment and from Uncle Sam across the board on munitions, and really focused on cheap, scalable munitions. Simon looks confused.
Yeah, was it last week or 2 weeks ago, Dave? We talked about the... last week or the week before, Dave, I think we talked about Boeing delivering or offering a much lower cost interceptor variant into the inventory, which was compelling, not least because this is a legacy player introducing something, you know, lower cost and innovative. This is obviously one kind of one element in a growing trend line of replacing legacy expensive legacy capabilities with lower cost attritable capabilities. And it's interesting to see legacy players get involved with that, right? Not just legacy capabilities, but legacy players actually buying into the innovation mandate. Talk to us a bit more about what else goes into that. It seems like an all of the above kind of an approach.
It is. I think the sentiment in the room, or in all the rooms right now, is the like historical analog of like a Tiger tank could beat a Sherman tank, but it couldn't beat Detroit. And what we really need to do to prepare for the next conflict is figure out where the Sherman tanks are going to come from in every variety. And that looks like lots and lots of precision munitions, lots and lots of protection munitions that Uncle Sam can scale up very quickly to extremely high quantities at relatively low cost. Mm. That is the game. And I think that everybody from the mid-level acquisitions layer all the way up to the senior echelons of the Pentagon is intensely focused on that problem. Let's build a bunch of Sherman tanks. Like Tiger tanks have been very appropriate for the last 20 years of low intensity conflict. But where are our Sherman tanks?
Yeah, I like that. Tigers could beat Shermans, but couldn't beat Detroit. Is that your quote? I mean, like, because that's beautiful.
No, I definitely stole that from somebody.
Okay, I dig it. Simon, you look skeptical. I can see the furrowed brow, the scowl.
This is nonsense. These are tactical solutions to deep strategic problems. Low cost and attritable. The more time I spend here, I think it's a joke. And the reason I think it's a joke is because the cost can only be measured against the gain, i.e. what do we achieve with this objective? So if it costs me a whole bunch of $3 million missiles and the other country capitulates, the cost was right on the money. I do not care. The problem is we have no concept of like which war we're going to fight against who, or what our strategic objectives will be. So we are like playing this zero-sum game of everything needs to be cheaper, and somehow the defense budget also needs to be dramatically larger. And very little attention is being paid to like the efficiency of the spend in that scenario. So like, it's very hard for me to stomach. Well, I take that back. We, our industry and people like us, are solving for problems that are within our scope and within our grasp. And like, that's just what you do. right? There's no two ways around it. But I can't imagine a world where, like, if only we had cheap interceptors, we would have gotten a different outcome in Iran, for example, right? Like, that wasn't the problem there. Mm-hmm. We happen to have created, like, a logistical problem that we're all now throwing our backs into to solve. But we're just going to solve it and then do what? The same thing again to somebody else where we, like, tank oil prices in order to use cheap drones instead of big drones. So I feel like we're talking around what the major issue is, and not everyone agrees, right? There's arguments about hypersonics versus ballistics and what the right mix is. There's never enough 155 rounds. I still don't think cost is the problem. Supply chain is a real problem, which is you can throw infinite number of dollars at 155 rounds and you will be restricted by the plants that exist in the real world that can do the metallurgy and can do the energetics. That is not something that you can just buy.
That's the point.
Amount of capital.
They're attempting to sign up. Uncle Sam is attempting to sign up for production contracts that incentivize industry to reduce those bottlenecks now. I reject the, like, we can't look into a crystal ball and identify what the next conflict's going to be like, so we don't know what munition. There's some common denominators where we're absolutely going to need. We need rounds. We're going to need counter-air rounds. We're going to need air denial rounds. We're going to need surface-to-surface. We're going to need surface-to-ship. And we're going to need high volume of all of those things, regardless of whatever conflict it is.
If the goal, and I think this is the goal, is to deter the next big open conflict, which I think is always kind of the strategic imperative behind large scaled industry level investments and policy adjustments in the United States and in the West. If that's true, I think I'd buy, Dave, the idea that this is a leading indicator of whether we are adequately prepared to deter, and in parentheses, win the next conflict. And it should at some level, I mean, this is kind of like, what is the impact of developing the nuclear triad during the Cold War? It wasn't that we won the nuclear war that happened. It was that we deterred the nuclear war from happening. Similarly, I think what we're doing with inspiring industry to get on board with lower cost, higher volume, and responsive supply chains backing up this type of capability, we are presenting a problem, an escalation problem to the Iranians, to the Russians, to the Chinese, to the name your adversary. And we're probably not going to get it perfectly, you know, right. We won't get the formulation or the mixture completely right, but we've got to do something. We can't just sit back and, like, pray and hope.
Yes, we're just trying to prove to the world that Uncle Sam can still outproduce, that Detroit will still beat the Tiger.
We are the Tiger. We're building the Tiger. If the Cold War is the analogy, we're the other side of the coin. We are extremely exquisite. We are over-leveraging ourselves, and we're doing it very publicly. The Chinese are the cheap production powerhouse. Like, we got to figure out new math.
Now, there's a cheap production powerhouse in all categories, right? Even AI, right? Because they do this, I forget what it's called. It's like a derivative modeling off of frontier model work and investment that goes on in the United States. And then they deliver a very low-cost AI solution that displaces so much of the, you know, the consumer and prosumer and enterprise level AI usage and everything else. Yes, I think that's just a fact that you have to contend with and is the result of economic coupling that happened decades ago.
But Simon, China's investments there were like China's advantages with low cost production just further prove my point, do they not? I mean,
only if you think you can out brute force them.
Isn't the point here that you want to present the deterrent effect, right? That's the point. Yes. It's not that you want to out brute force them. It's that you want to present a challenge, a counterpoint.
I don't know that we've deterred anyone.
China still has not directly attacked, right? They haven't moved on Taiwan.
Yeah, disproving a negative, right? China has, when's the last time China invaded anybody? Vietnam in the 70s?
Okay, so hold on a sec. Simon, what is the alternative?
What is the alternative?
What would you prefer to see our industry do?
That's why I preface this whole thing. We are coming up with tactical solutions to a strategic problem. We're going to go dig the ditch regardless of what direction the ditch goes, because we know how to dig ditches. And it would be insanity for me to sit here and be like, man, good thing we're all breaking our backs because it's going a good way, while I'm watching, like, gas skyrocket and more maximum pressure campaign be rolled out. What is the thing we're actually worried about? Because I'll tell you, if we really want to have a big, strong deterrent, spending all of your munitions on Iran was not the way to like prove to the world that I've got the deterrent in my back pocket. All we've proved to the world is that maybe we're running out of stuff.
So the topic here is reinvestment in a new form of munition magazine depth production and supply chains. So in a situation where the magazine is being depleted, I don't think anybody publicly really knows how depleted or fully or somewhere, who knows.
Right.
But in a situation where magazine has been drawn down significantly and maybe critically, what are we to do, right? Well, why not take this as an opportunity to invest in a different, nimbler, lighter, lower cost, higher volume version of the thing we had before that is maybe tooled more specifically to 21st century deterrence against peer competitors. Like, I'm not saying that that decision from here going forward in no way judges the previous action of drawdown on the magazine as correct. Right.
You are on like the most interesting question, right? Which is like, what do we do next? And where is your energy best spent? I do think the most like fascinating touch point is the one you led with, which is, you know, Boeing turning its energy toward this game, because still up to this point, all of the venture raised and all of the contracts of our like defense tech renaissance is one submarine contract, not even a whole submarine contract, right? So like the DOD is still not really investing in this problem at the scale. And it's particularly if you look at this year's budget request, had a whole new class of exquisite battleship that did not exist before that will once again blow all of our industry out of the water. And like, it sends the opposite signal that we're not investing magazine depth. We're just going to pick a new shiny object. So don't get me wrong. I want to see lots of folks in this industry win, not only because I'm participating in it, but because I think it's a more responsible way of like handling national and international security. But I can't say I'm super jazzed and optimistic at the moment.
Well, so like, One of the potential evolutions that we'll see as the defense renaissance, you know, in the innovation economy and the venture community gets involved and matures, and that evolves over time. One of the interesting evolutions we discussed a couple of weeks ago, Boeing's partial acquisition or stake in Archer, right? And so this whole idea that like the innovative energy comes from the fecund trenches of venture-backed Silicon Valley operations, and most of those companies will fail. But what happens to that IP? What happens to those teams? What happens to those contract vehicles? What happens to all that stuff? Well, in some of those cases, and some of those will be big successes, they'll get absorbed into the M&A engines, the corporate development engines of those very large players, the Boeings, the RTXs, the Lockheeds, the et cetera. Especially as some of those bigger entities are getting doged, they're being told formally that they are not innovating enough, right? So they have all this capital depth. They need to deploy it. You can deploy it through CVC. You can deploy it into your corporate development and M&A engines. I think we're seeing that in the case of the Boeing Archer relationship, which interestingly started with a lawsuit. So we're going to see more of that too, right? Just as the innovation economy heats up, it will inevitably lead to more friction between the legacy set and the rising non-traditional set. And we'll see what happens. But I think the net result of that will be positive in the sense of capability deployment at lower cost, at higher volume, in the way that Dave is describing. Or maybe not at lower cost, because the United States doesn't ever spend less.
Yeah,
so
hold on. I say one more thing, Gary, because rarely disagree.
Yeah, go.
So I agree that it always starts with a strategic problem. Right. Not something that's in my sphere to influence. And well, until someone taps me as Secretary of Defense, which is obviously just days away. I'm going to focus on the tactical problem. And in my mind, you mentioned China. China designed, you know, their low cost air denial weapons that they have on every piece of terrain that they own, specifically to sink 7th Fleet. So my argument is the investments that we should be making as a credible deterrent to China is not more 7th Fleet. It's more USVs, it's more Saronics of the world. It is a volume game, whether you're talking about big blue water Navy or long range precision fires.
Deter China from what? Defending their homeland with air defense weapons? What are we talking about?
Not
if they had built a giant like expeditionary military, I'd be like, oh shit, we need to be able to deter. They have not built a capability.
No, you know what they
go, they're getting ready to invade.
That's actually not, I would argue that's not true, Simon. They have built an enormous gray zone capacity that operates in impact in the same way that like a traditional kind of blue water surface navy would
operate. I agree,
right?
They built a mass air zone capacity, which we can't counter with missiles and like hypersonics because they're going to stay below the threshold. That's the strategic solution.
Which again requires innovation to confront a gray zone activity, right? And that's everything, right? It's not just like military capability. In fact, it's probably less of the military capability and more of the, you know, the whole range of diplomatic, economic, et cetera, you know, pressure, alliance structures, like all of those things.
There was an article in The Hill recently that basically was making the case that we're not in a Cold War, that we're in World War IV. It has already started, and China's going to fight World War IV without ever shooting a single bullet. And I think that's a much more interesting strategic conundrum that we should. I mean, you've been hearing me saying, I don't ever think China's going to invade Taiwan because it doesn't make any mathematical sense for where they are strongest and how they are strongest and how they are positioned to achieve their ends. And I think that, like, we have a handful of plays that we know historically. We're like, we should run those back to position ourselves to deter thing.
You know what I thought, Simon? I thought Dolly Parton was never going to die. And you know what?
She was 80.
You know?
You need to recognize that these people are old and these strategies are old.
You got to recognize that China's old and they have for a long time considered Taiwan a rogue province, right? And that it is now a matter of national pride, party pride, personality pride to like do something there. I'm not saying that they will. I'm just saying that like...
I don't disagree. I think we have misdiagnosed what the toolkit is for a foreign mindset. If it was America looking at Taiwan, we would for sure invade. That's what doing something looks like to America's foreign policy toolkit. I don't think that's what it looks like for China.
Maybe. I don't know. Maybe.
Right. We're going to argue it in counterfactual. I'm counting down until 2030. I can't wait. I'm calling dozens of people to be like, we hit the clock, fellas.
Dozens.
You're on a defense technology podcast. Yeah. In a range of strategic options, my only point is I would like the entire world to know that Uncle Sam has a really deep magazine depth.
Mm. Yeah. And an innovative economy that can produce things quicker to confront emerging problems, right?
Can we not feel the anxiety of us working on an issue while the new battleship's being announced? It's just like, motherfucker, how many times? I'm begging you.
Okay. All right. So we're gonna cap off the conversation here with a couple of items in the Defense Venture News news stack. First, I mean, I'm going to talk about two deals, one very briefly and the other with a little bit more depth. The two major rounds that we've seen in the past couple of weeks, Muon Space, which is a space as a service, kind of like client-specific, fully managed low Earth orbit sensor payload vehicle space platform company, raised $250 million in a Series C led by Eclipse. Interesting because space is still the frontier, right? I mean, it's still heating up. It's still very interesting. And this is definitively a dual use capability. The other defense investment of note is definitively not a dual use capability. And it is Castelion, which raised $800 million in equity, and I think just over $1 billion in all the mechanisms and vehicles that were put together in the round, and emerged from that as a $13 billion category leader in the hypersonic space. It was led by A16Z with participation or co-leadership by Carlyle and JP Morgan and a range of others. But they've taken money from, you know, folks friendly with our company, including General Catalyst, Lightspeed, Altimeter, and others. It just closed. I think it's closing now or just closed or something. I don't have the exact date there. But I think this is interesting because we talk a lot about category leadership and the most volume of defense venture activity happens for category leaders. And in fact, you know, 85 to 90% of all venture activity in the defense space over the past 18 months has gone to the top 10 or so category defining or category leading non-traditional defense contractors, and that is no different for Castelion. That is making waves in fully vertically integrated hypersonic capability. Maybe some quick comments before we close out. Simon, we had a conversation a couple of weeks ago with Dmitry Alperovich, one of our guests of CrowdStrike fame and a big thinker in terms of, you know, we're already in a Cold War, and he was pretty down on the idea of hypersonics as an investable or as an important defense category for the venture economy. I think we broadly disagree, but we did just come off a conversation with Dave about, you know, magazine depth and kind of an all of the above approach and reducing cost for increasing capability. But Hypersonics, talk to us about it.
This is an existing class of weapons that the Russians have used in real life. to mm-hmm. say that we should not be investing would be like the height of irresponsibility. Not yeah. optional. Has to yeah. be a part of the mix. No two ways around it. Castilian, at the bare minimum, definitively shows the demand here, right? This is a four-year-old company by a whole team of SpaceX alumni who also came from like Johns Hopkins and all these other places. These are 30-year pros. These are not like young kids saying, I'm going to jump into totally. Hypersonics.
This is a many of them,
massive
many
amount of them, capital. Like
totally. Many of them come from like SpaceX leadership, right? So like this is like the creme de la creme working on a major defense yeah. industrial problem.
Yeah. The Castilian LinkedIn, if you look at it, it just has a big piece through deterrence. Like if you want to talk about deterrence, if it exists anywhere, it's hypersonics. Totally.
Yeah.
As I struggle greatly with like the utility of nuclear deterrence and like what the right mix is, right? Do we need air, sea, and land, right? How much of that was just like internal political infighting versus actually what the right mix is? Right. Hypersonics is a different ballgame entirely. It's much totally. More usable. And if you don't have this capability to defeat enemy air defense systems, you're going to be asked out. So yeah. I think it's great. Glad to see Castilian doing the work here. There's tons of great folks doing work in this space. There's primes, there's new entrants, you know, Crane and TRMC, and like there's lots of government partners that are focused on this problem set. This is right down the middle of like where we should be as far as our exquisite capabilities are interested.
But Dave,
that was literally one of the four examples that I used that you objected to.
Yeah, I've put myself in the box of, you know, Simon, think about this in the context. Also, you know, Dimitri, the guest, was like, I don't believe in it. Right. So if I'm arguing against the I don't believe in it, yeah, I can. I'm happy to take a more reasoned approach. But if I'm arguing from like this is going to solve our problems, it's not. It's a tactical issue.
or perhaps just a bit more nuanced perspective. I think he was kind of leaning in the direction of, you know, traditional ballistics investment, ballistic magazine depth right. and other things, which I think, Dave, I think we would agree here in this conversation. You want all of the above.
I don't care if it's hypersonics or not. It's all long range precision fires.
Yep. Like, yeah, that is the army man perspective in a big way, which I appreciate more than anything. Of like, I don't care what hits the thing, something fast and far away has to hit the thing so I can walk across the field.
You got me on that one. Fix that's 100% where I'm at.
Which I agree. Like, once again, that's the strategic problem. My army can't move from here to there. All this other stuff, which we spend all of our time focused on, is like, okay, how do I solve that? What do they have? What do we have? These are the tactics and logistics of solving the strategic issue. The problem is, will our army ever walk across a field again? Or will the Chinese stay right below ever needing to meet the U.S. Army in battle? And that's why, if I had to bet right now with the information I have, that's the bet I would place. Who would want to take that fight?
If we can ratchet up even more maximum pressure without actually putting boots on the ground.
If only there was a way to find more pressure.
Simon, it pains my infantry soul to say this, but like I don't, it's not the last 100 meters anymore. It's the last 100 miles.
Yeah, no, like all it's the whole field. You can't walk one step. So why would we field the army at all? And this is like the Air Force would love to have that conversation, right? Like air power is going to solve it. Air power is going to solve nothing. It changes none of the like political calculus. The army changes the political calculus, but in order to get the army there, you have to roll up those fires, right? So like all of these pieces have to play. It cannot just be one. It cannot be infinite airstrikes and then I sanctioned your rich people. That doesn't change the calculus. And we have decades now of GWAT examples to prove like, poof, anything short of crushing you is not enough.
So a couple of final comments here and then we'll wrap. Congratulations to the Castilian team. Big stuff. I think we're applauding their evolution and growth. They're saying that their Blackbeard, yes, the Blackbeard, which is a great product name for their for their mainline product, will be fieldable in 2027 with a dev cycle and test and experimentation and kind of certification set of milestones over the subsequent couple of years enabled by the investment, and comes in at something like $500,000 a copy, which for a hypersonic, you know, long range precision fire platform sounds affordable given the legacy capabilities. So congratulations to them. All right, Simon, I gotta say, man, when you repeat a shirt, it gets less fun. That being said, we've gained lots of followers over the years since you last wore the share shirt. So do you want to talk about your your love affair with Cher as an act.
Dressed to Kill tour 2014. It's got the dates on the back, which is very important. I didn't go. I thrifted it. But Cher's also very old. You never know when you're going to lose one of these titans. So it felt appropriate. Given that I don't have a Dolly Parton shirt, it felt like my next best thing of a living legend I do have a shirt of. But
sounds like you got to go to that same thrift shop and pick up some Dolly stuff.
What'd you say, Dave? What about Cher?
Did you just jinx Cher?
No, I didn't jinx her.
Not cool.
Time. Not cool, bro. Jinxed her. That's how this works. No one gets out of this game, fellas. You gotta go one day.
Nah, dude. Nah. We're the generation who'll live forever.
Yeah. Us That's and Cher. Us. Cher will be the That's first us. One to live forever in a robot body. She's paving the way right now.
Love it. Okay, gents, thank you. Awesome conversation. Psyched to be back in the saddle after our short break a couple of weeks ago. If you are new to the show, hopefully you got what you wanted and more. And send us notes if you want to hear us cover topics or invite guests onto the pod for discussion and contribution to this very necessary and totally not vibe patriotism podcast. We are psyched about what's going on, and we'll continue bushwhacking. Till then, see ya.